Welcome to another deep dive. We're spending our time today unpacking the anatomy of a systemic commercial failure.
Yeah, a really massive one.
Exactly. We're specifically looking at a landmark 1993 arbitration case. This was handled by the China International Economic and Trade Arbitration Commission.
Right. Universally known in the industry as CITAC.
CITAC, exactly. And we're looking at a deal between a Chinese buyer and a United States seller involving the international sale of high tensile steel bars.
Which is, you know, a very specific type of commodity.
It is. And this was a deal that didn't just hit a snag. It completely and entirely collapsed.
Total failure.
Right. So for those of you managing cross-border supply chains or navigating international commercial law, the source material we are pulling from today provides a really stark look at the mechanics of the CISG.
The contracts for the international sale of goods.
Yes. We are getting into the gritty realities of fundamental breach, avoidance, and that heavily contested battleground of calculating lost profits when downstream commitments just shatter. Okay, let's unpack this.
To really frame the commercial reality of this dispute, we have to look at the baseline of the transaction. So their year is 1993. The asset is high tensile steel bars.
Right. Not exactly consumer electronics.
No, not at all. In the context of global trade, especially involving China's massive industrialization during that era, we aren't talking about consumer goods sitting on a retail shelf somewhere.
Yeah.
High tensile steel is the literal skeleton of heavy infrastructure. It reinforces concrete in major commercial developments, you know, bridges, industrial facilities.
Foundational stuff.
Exactly. So the Chinese buyer entered into this purchase agreement with a very specific, aggressive intent for its downstream commercial operations. They were sourcing this steel to feed an active, hungry supply chain.
Which means the steel wasn't just an isolated asset sitting in a vacuum. It was a critical dependency.
Absolutely.
I mean, the moment that contract was signed, the buyer likely locked in their own downstream obligations. They probably had, you know, secondary contracts with construction firms or regional manufacturers.
Promising delivery based entirely on the arrival of that U.S. shipment.
Right. So it's like, imagine you were in a bakery, right? And you order a very specific, highly refined flour for a massive wedding cake order you have due next week.
Right. A perfect analogy.
You aren't buying the flour just to hoard it in the back room.
Mm-hmm.
You're buying it because you've already promised the finished cake to someone else. If the flour doesn't show up, you don't just lose the flour, you lose the wedding contract.
You ruin the wedding.
Exactly. You ruin the wedding. So in this case, the timeline was set, the capital was allocated, and the operational schedule was locked. And then the U.S. seller simply failed to deliver.
Just a complete zero.
Not a delay, not a partial shipment, a zero. And according to the tribunal notes, they provided no adequate justification for the failure whatsoever.
What's fascinating here is how a total non-delivery strips away the usual ambiguities of a commercial dispute.
How do you mean?
Well, in a typical arbitration, you spend days, sometimes weeks, arguing over whether a two-week delay constitutes a material breach or, you know, whether a slight metallurgical variance in the steel fundamentally alters its utility.
Right, getting into the tiny details.
Exactly. But here, the complete abandonment of the contractual obligation forces us to look straight at the heaviest mechanisms of the CISG. The U.S. seller's failure triggered a cascading collapse.
Because the Chinese buyer couldn't fulfill their resale commitments.
Yes. They faced the immediate fallout of shattered downstream contracts, which inevitably lead to severe commercial loss, specifically the evaporation of their anticipated profits.
But declaring a total failure from the seller doesn't automatically, like, print a check for the buyer.
Oh, absolutely not.
It's not just a matter of showing up at CITAC and saying, okay, Hey, they didn't ship the steel, so give us our lost revenue.
Mm-hmm.
The buyer has to navigate a very strict sequence of legal hurdles under the CISG to even unlock the right to claim those damages.
Right. It's a very methodical process.
So the tribunal's first job was applying CISG Article 25. This is the threshold test for a fundamental breach.
Yeah, and Article 25 is essentially the gatekeeper for the most severe remedies under the convention.
The gatekeeper, I like that.
For a breach to be considered fundamental, it must result in such detriment to the other party as substantially to deprive them of what they were entitled to expect under the contract.
Substantially to deprive? That's heavy wording.
It is, and the language there is intentionally a high bar. The drafters of the CISG wanted to preserve contracts whenever possible. They favored price reductions or damage claims over outright termination.
Because they didn't want international trade constantly derailed by minor technicalities, right?
Precisely.
I'd imagine that in heavily volatile markets, buyers might actually look for minor technicalities to escape a contract if the market price suddenly drops.
Oh, all the time. That's a classic maneuver.
Like, if they agreed to buy steel at a premium and the global price crashes before delivery, a buyer might scour the shipment for the slightest nonconformity just to reject the goods and buy cheaper steel elsewhere.
Yeah, they'll complain about a scratch on a container.
Right. So Article 25 seems designed to prevent that kind of opportunistic behavior.
It absolutely is. It forces the tribunal to look at the core economic expectation of the contract. Did the breach destroy the fundamental value of the transaction for the innocent party?
And in our 1993 case?
Well, the application of Article 25 was brutally straightforward. When a buyer contracts for industrial steel meant for immediate downstream allocation and receives absolutely 0 tons of that steel, the substantial deprivation is total.
Right. There's no argument to be had.
None. The core expectation wasn't merely impaired, it was completely obliterated. The U.S. seller's complete failure to deliver easily satisfied the Article 25 criteria for a fundamental breach.
Which brings us to the next operational step. Once that fundamental breach is established, the buyer has a choice to make. And the source material points us to CISG Article 49.
Yes, Article 49.
Which governs the concept of avoidance, declaring the contract avoided. Now, in a layman's context, avoiding sounds passive, right? Like you're just ignoring the problem, like avoiding a phone call.
Right. It sounds like you're just walking away.
But in international commercial law, it's the nuclear option, isn't it?
It is the ultimate remedy. Declaring a contract avoided under Article 49 effectively releases both parties from their future obligations under that specific agreement, save for any damages that may be due.
So it formally terminates the active life of the contract.
Exactly. The buyer is saying, this deal is dead, but it requires an active declaration. You can't just silently walk away or ignore the seller. You have to put them on formal notice.
But wait, isn't declaring avoidance under Article 49 incredibly risky for the buyer?
It can be tremendously risky.
Let's say a buyer jumps the gun. They haven't received the goods on the exact specified date, so they immediately declare avoidance and go sign a replacement contract with a different supplier.
Happens more often than you'd think.
Right, and if an arbitration tribunal later reviews the case and decides that the initial delay wasn't actually a fundamental breach under Article 25, doesn't that make the buyer the party in breach for wrongfully terminating the agreement?
That is the exact trap that catches inexperienced procurement teams. Wrongful avoidance is a massive liability.
Wow.
If you pull the trigger on Article 49 without airtight justification under Article 25, you have just repudiated the contract.
So you become the bad guy.
Yes. Suddenly, the original seller, who might have only been guilty of a minor delay, can now sue you for their lost profits because you refuse to accept the late but legally viable delivery.
You completely flip from being the victim to being the liable party. That's terrifying.
It's a high wire act.
So what does this all mean for the Chinese buyer in 1993?
Okay.
They had to be absolutely certain of their ground.
They did.
By waiting for a complete unjustified failure to deliver, rather than jumping at a minor delay, they ensured their declaration of avoidance was bulletproof.
Right. The total non-delivery provided the necessary armor to invoke Article 49 safely.
And by successfully avoiding the contract, they didn't just free themselves from having to accept a late delivery if the U.S. seller suddenly showed up 6 months later. They opened the gateway to Articles 74 and 76.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the sequence is deeply methodical.
Walk us through it.
So Article 25 establishes the severity. Article 49 terminates the ongoing obligation. And then Article 74 and 76 step in to clean up the financial wreckage.
The damages phase.
Exactly. Article 74 is the general rule for damages under the CISG. It dictates that damages equal the loss, including the loss of profits suffered by the other party as a consequence of the breach.
So it's about making them whole.
Yes. The underlying philosophy is expectation damages, putting the injured party in the financial position they would have occupied had the contract been flawlessly performed.
Expectation damages sound great in theory, but proving them in practice seems like a nightmare.
Oh, it's incredibly difficult.
I mean, if the Chinese buyer claims they lost profits from downstream construction contracts, they're essentially asking the tribunal to compensate them for a hypothetical future that never happened.
That's a good way to put it.
The source notes highlight that recovery under Article 74 isn't just about refunding a deposit. It's about capturing that lost margin. But how does a tribunal actually verify what that margin would have been in the complex reality of 1990s Chinese industry?
Well, they require rigorous, almost exhaustive documentary evidence, which we will definitely get to when we discuss the practical takeaways. But before a tribunal even looks at a ledger, they have to consider an alternative and sometimes simpler route for calculating the financial hit.
Article 76.
Yes, that is where CISG Article 76 comes into play. The notes refer to this as the market-based method for assessing damages.
Right. Article 76 provides an abstract calculation. If the contract is avoided and there is a current price for the goods in question, the buyer can claim the difference between the price fixed in the contract and the current market price at the time of avoidance.
Exactly.
So let me make sure I have the math right.
Right.
If the Chinese buyer locked in a favorable contract price of, say, $300 a ton for the steel, and by the time they declare avoidance, the global market price is spiked to $450 a ton, they can claim that $150 per ton difference as damages.
Assuming they haven't made a specific substitute purchase, yes, that's the formula.
Okay.
Article 76 is designed for situations where proving exact subjective lost profits through internal company data is either too difficult or where the buyer simply chose not to execute a cover transaction.
It gives them a baseline.
Right. It uses the objective market reality to measure the loss of the bargain. However, applying Article 76 introduces highly contested variables, specifically regarding the phrase time of avoidance.
Because the market price of industrial commodities like high tensile steel fluctuates daily.
Hourly sometimes.
Wow. So if you are claiming the difference between the contract price and the market price, the exact date you pull that market price from dictates the size of your damages claim.
It's the whole ballgame.
If a buyer declares avoidance on a Tuesday when the market is spiking, their damages claim is massive. If they wait until Friday when the market dips, their claim shrinks.
And that is why the precise establishment of the time of avoidance is heavily litigated. Opposing counsel will fight tooth and nail over what day that actually occurred.
That makes sense.
Furthermore, Article 76 requires a current price at the place where delivery of the goods should have been made.
Oh, so location matters too.
Hugely. If the contract stipulated deliver at a specific port in China, you need the market price at that specific port, not the global average.
Which might not be easy to find.
Exactly. If there isn't a reliable published exchange price for that specific grade of steel at that specific location, you have to find reasonable substitutes, which opens up entirely new avenues for the opposing counsel to attack your damages calculation.
It becomes a battle of economic experts arguing over what the true market price actually was on a highly specific Tuesday in 1993.
A very expensive battle.
So while Article 76 offers a quote-unquote abstract method, it's far from simple. It seems that in our SciTech case, the tribunal relied heavily on the general damages rule under Article 74, focusing intently on the actual loss of profit resulting from the ruined downstream operations.
They did.
Which pushes us directly into the core of the tribunal's reasoning.
Mm.
They had a total failure to deliver. They had a clean declaration of avoidance. Now they had to deal with the buyer's claim for lost profits.
And this is where the tribunal had to deploy the ultimate filter for any damages claim under contract law. The principle of foreseeability. Yes. It is not enough for the Chinese buyer to simply prove that they lost money because the U.S. seller didn't deliver. The legal standard demands a much tighter causal link.
So they can't just throw all their losses at the seller.
Right. Under the CISG, damages may not exceed the loss which the party in breach foresaw or ought to have foreseen at the time of the conclusion of the contract.
Ought to have foreseen at the time of the conclusion of the contract. That wording is critical.
Very.
It shifts the timeline. The tribunal isn't looking at what the U.S. seller knew when they breached the contract. They are looking at what the U.S. seller reasonably should have known on the day they signed the contract.
Yes, it is a retrospective assessment of assumed knowledge.
This raises an important question regarding the burden of commercial awareness. How deeply must an international seller understand their buyer's operational environment?
That's the crux of it. The foreseeability test acts as a circuit breaker against infinite liability.
Like a domino effect.
Exactly. If the non-delivery of steel causes the Chinese buyer's manufacturing plant to shut down, which causes them to default on a government contract, which leads to their bankruptcy, which causes a regional banking crisis.
The U.S. seller cannot be held liable for the banking crisis.
Right. The chain of causation has to be cut off at the boundary of reasonable commercial expectation.
So how did the CITAG arbitrators draw that boundary in this specific case? I mean, the U.S. seller might have argued, hey, we are just a steel exporter. We had no idea this specific buyer was relying on our exact shipment to fulfill critical construction contracts. We didn't know their business model.
A classic defense.
Yeah. Therefore, their lost profits from those downstream contracts were unforeseeable, and we shouldn't have to pay them.
And that is a standard defense. But the tribunal forcefully rejected that premise by looking at the intrinsic nature of the goods and the identity of the parties.
Okay, unpacking that a bit.
They reasoned that this was a large-scale commercial sale within the international steel trade. The buyer was a commercial entity, not an end consumer building a personal backyard project.
Right. In the heavy industrial sector, you do not purchase massive quantities of high tensile steel bars to let them sit idle in a storage yard.
Exactly.
The capital cost of holding that much inventory without turning it over would be financial suicide. The only logical reason a commercial entity engages in an international transaction of this scale is to utilize the material for profit.
Either through direct manufacturing, construction, or immediate resale to secondary distributors.
Precisely. The tribunal established that resale or downstream utilization is not some bizarre outlier scenario.
Yeah.
It is the natural, inevitable, and primary commercial consequence of the transaction itself.
It's what the goods are for.
Therefore, the moment the U.S. seller signed a contract to supply commercial-grade industrial steel to a Chinese corporate buyer, they were put on constructive notice.
Yeah.
They ought to have foreseen that failing to deliver that steel would rupture the buyer's downstream revenue streams.
By operating in that specific industry, the U.S. seller essentially inherited the baseline knowledge of how that industry functions. You can't enter the global steel trade and plead ignorance to the fact that your buyers are using the steel to make money.
Right, you can't play dumb.
Exactly. The tribunal ruled that because the buyer's lost resale opportunities were a natural consequence of the trade, those lost profits were foreseeable in principle. The U.S. seller couldn't hide behind a veil of ignorance.
It is a critical ruling because it solidifies the presumption of commercial intent under the CISG.
It really does.
When dealing with industrial commodities between corporate actors, tribunals will presume that the goods are intended for profitable downstream use. The burden shifts.
Yes. The seller would have to prove that there was some highly unusual, completely unpredictable element to the buyer's downstream contracts to escape liability for those lost profits.
That sets a very rigid standard for international suppliers. It means your risk profile isn't just the value of the goods you were shipping, it's the value of the business your buyer intends to conduct with those goods.
It magnifies the stakes.
But establishing that the lost profits were foreseeable in principle is only half the war.
True.
The tribunal saying, yes, it's foreseeable that you lost profits. Well, that doesn't answer the question of how much exactly did you lose.
Right, the actual quantum of damages.
This takes us straight into the practical takeaways from the source material. How do modern businesses take the lessons from this 1993 collapse and apply them to their own supply chain risk management?
The intelligence we extract from this case operates on two distinct fronts: the defensive perimeter you build during contract drafting and the evidentiary arsenal you compile during the execution phase.
Let's tackle the drafting precision first.
Okay. As we discussed, the 1993 case was analytically simple because it involved a total 100% failure to deliver. But corporate counsel rarely get such clean scenarios.
Right. Most supply chain disputes live in the gray areas. The shipment arrives, but it's 3 weeks late. Or it arrives on time, but it's 15% short of the agreed volume.
Or the quality is just slightly off.
Yeah, exactly. The steel is delivered, but the metallurgical composition is slightly off, making it unsuitable for the specific high-stress application the buyer intended, but perfectly fine for a lower-grade application.
In those nuanced scenarios, the fight over whether a breach is fundamental under Article 25 becomes a vicious, protracted battle. Is a three-week delay a substantial deprivation?
Depends on the market, right?
Exactly. If the market is stable and the buyer has buffer inventory, a tribunal might say no, it's just a minor breach. You get some damages for storage or administrative hassle, but you don't get to avoid the contract and claim massive lost profits.
But if that three-week delay caused the buyer to miss a strict non-negotiable delivery window with their own downstream client, resulting in the cancellation of a multi-million dollar secondary contract, then that delay is absolutely a fundamental deprivation to that specific buyer.
Without a doubt.
The problem is, how does the tribunal know that 3 weeks was fatal?
They don't. Not unless you told them in the contract. And that is the paramount drafting lesson. You cannot rely on an arbitrator's generalized understanding of your business needs to peck you.
You have to spell it out.
If a specific delivery date, a precise technical specification, or a rigid volume requirement is essential to your downstream operations, you must elevate that condition within the text of the contract.
You have to explicitly link the specific obligation to the threshold of a fundamental breach. You don't just write delivery by October 1st.
No, that's too weak.
You write time is of the essence. The buyer's downstream manufacturing schedule relies entirely on delivery by October 1st. Any delay beyond this date fundamentally deprives the buyer of the contract's value and constitutes a fundamental breach under CISG Article 25, entitling the buyer to immediate avoidance.
Exactly. You engineer your own legal safety net. You define the parameters of substantial deprivation before the breach ever occurs.
Predefining the damage.
Yes. By hard coding your essential expectations into the agreement, you remove the tribunal's need to guess whether a partial failure was devastating. You have already agreed with the seller that it be.
That's brilliant.
This entirely mitigates the risk of wrongful avoidance we discussed earlier. If the contract explicitly defines a 3-day delay as fundamental, and the seller is 4 days late, your avoidance is protected by the text itself.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Even if you have the tightest contract in the world, and you perfectly execute your avoidance under Article 49, you still have to prove the exact quantum of your lost profits under Article 74.
You do.
And the tribunal notes from the Scientac case make it abundantly clear that the evidentiary foundation for a lost profits claim is unforgiving.
The burden of proof rests entirely on the party claiming the damages. It is a grueling standard. The tribunal accepted that the Chinese buyer's lost profits were foreseeable in principle due to the nature of the steel trade. But in principle doesn't calculate a monetary award?
It doesn't write the check.
Exactly. The buyer had to provide a forensic accounting of the damage.
They couldn't just submit a document saying, we generally make a 20% margin on steel, you failed to deliver 10,000 tons, so owe us the margin on that volume.
No, that is way too speculative.
The law requires a concrete demonstration of causation. You have to prove an unbroken direct line between the U.S. seller's failure and the specific dollars missing from your bank account.
Which means the battle for damages is won or lost in your internal record-keeping practices. To successfully claim lost profits on downstream contracts, the buyer must produce those executed secondary contracts.
They have to show their homework.
Everything. They need to show the tribunal the exact resale price they had locked in with their own customers. If the downstream contracts were canceled because of the U.S. seller's non-delivery, the buyer needs the formal cancellation notices.
The penalty invoices they had to pay to their own clients.
Yes. And the internal correspondence proving that the sole reason for the cancellation was the lack of the specific U.S. steel.
In 1993, that meant a mountain of physical paper. We are talking about telexes, carbon copy purchase orders, physical bills of lading, stamped customs documents, and formal letters of credit.
A literal paper trail.
If a buyer received a cancellation notice from a downstream client via a phone call and didn't document it with a follow-up telex, that evidence effectively didn't exist for the tribunal.
And while the medium has shifted from telexes to secure emails, ERP system logs, and digital supply chain tracking, the evidentiary burden remains exactly the same. Furthermore, the buyer must prove they attempted to mitigate their losses.
Mitigation.
Under CISG Article 77, a party claiming damages must take reasonable measures to mitigate the loss, including loss of profit.
That is a crucial point. If the U.S. seller breaches, the Chinese buyer can't just sit back, let their downstream contracts collapse, and say, great, I'll just sue the U.S. seller for all of it.
No, they have an active duty to try and stop the bleeding.
They have to go into the market and attempt to find replacement steel.
And if they don't even try to find a replacement, the tribunal will reduce their damages award by the amount that could have been mitigated. This loops back to the evidentiary burden.
More paperwork.
Always. The buyer must document their mitigation efforts. They need logs showing they contacted alternative suppliers. They need the quotes from those suppliers proving that the replacement steel was either unavailable in the required time frame or prohibitively expensive.
And if they did find replacement steel?
If they did secure a replacement contract, they need all the documentation for that substitute transaction to calculate damages under Article 75.
It requires a level of institutional paranoia. You have to operate under the assumption that every communication, every market quote, and every internal operational adjustment might one day need to be presented to an arbitral tribunal to justify your financial survival.
That's a very pragmatic way to look at it.
If you are relying on Article 76, the market-based calculation, you need rigorous proof of the current price. You can't just print out a generic commodity chart.
No, you need authenticated market reports, expert testimony from industry pricing indices, or documented spot market offers from the exact time and place of avoidance. The overarching lesson from the CyAttack Tribunal's approach is that the CISG provides a powerful machinery for making an injured party whole, but it requires the injured party to supply the fuel for that machinery through immaculate documentation.
The rights granted by Articles 25, 49, and 74 are inert without the evidentiary mass to trigger them.
Perfectly said. You can be the completely innocent victim of a blatant, unjustified repudiation, but if your internal supply chain documentation is fragmented, your lost profit claim will disintegrate under cross-examination.
It is a phenomenal distillation of commercial risk. We've traced the anatomy of this collapse from the initial non-delivery of high-tensile steel in 1993 all the way through the interlocking mechanics of the CISG.
It's a journey.
We saw how a total failure to perform easily met the high bar of substantial deprivation under Article 25, which provided the Chinese buyer the necessary leverage to safely declare the contract avoided under Article 49.
Right.
We unpack the complexities of seeking expectation damages under Article 74 and the abstract market calculations of Article 76, highlighting the intense friction surrounding the establishment of market prices and the exact time of avoidance.
The real battlegrounds.
And we dug deeply into the tribunal's reasoning on foreseeability, how operating in a commercial industrial sector automatically puts a seller on notice that their buyer relies on the shipment for downstream revenue.
They ought to have known.
Ultimately, the survival of the wronged party didn't depend solely on the law being on their side. It depended on their ability to contractually define their essential expectations and forensically prove their financial reality.
As we conclude our analysis of this arbitration, consider the operational posture of your own organization or the clients you advise. Audit the assumptions embedded in your supply chain agreements.
It's worth the time.
Are the specific thresholds that would constitute a fundamental breach to your business explicitly defined in the text? Or are you relying on the assumed commercial awareness of your counterparties? If a critical supplier unilaterally halted performance tomorrow, does your procurement team possess the immediate, systematized evidentiary discipline to document the downstream fallout, prove active mitigation, and substantiate a lost profits claim before a tribunal?
A tough question.
The framework of international trade law is designed to restore balance, but it only rewards the parties who have engineered their contracts and their archives to interface with that framework perfectly.
A vital standard to measure against. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Keep questioning the structural integrity of your agreements, keep your evidentiary trails unbroken, and we will catch you next time.